Oh, hey, didn't see you there. Welcome to Secondary Fermentation, episode number 78.
Looking great.
Wow. As usual, this is Joe, joined by...
Elsie.
And as usual, Nick.
Wow, he sounds so
Nick,
excited.
Thrilled to be here.
No, I'm actually really excited to drink some beer today.
Oh, we're not drinking any beer today.
What?
We're just talking about it.
Why? How do you expect me to read about beer all day and not crave
a beer?
A beer or okay. Two.
Speaking of which,
I'll go ahead and crack one.
Ooh.
That sounded great from here.
That was a crispy quack. Get some pouring audio for these ASMR folks. So this beer that Lauren is aggressively pouring over there, making just cascades of foam, was sent to us in a lovely little surprise beer mail from our friend Matt.
Thanks, Matt. This is actually the first one of eight beers that we're trying.
Yes.
But thought it'd be really cool to try it and taste it live for everybody. So we've got here a beer from... Hidden Springs Ale Works, which is in Tampa, Florida. It's called Love That For You.
Love That For You.
Love That For You.
I just love the name of it.
That's why, yeah,
that's why we
grabbed it for today. Love That For You. And also, you know, I saw the style in there. What is it? Strawberry Shortcake Style Sour or something like that?
Yeah, it's a sour ale inspired with strawberry shortcake in mind.
Mm.
And this was a, I believe this was kind of part of the Tampa Bay Beer Week, which Matt was telling us about. And
yeah.
There's actually some special releases that we have from that Tampa Bay Beer Week that were released only for that purpose. So
ooh.
Excited to crack into those. But yeah, this is a really neat looking can. It's got that nice like teal kind of seafoam color, flamingo with a bunch of fruit. Just happy things like rainbows and
brown
palm trees
and
UFOs.
Yeah, and UFOs. Happy little UFOs.
Oh, it smells so good.
Yeah, I love strawberry shortcake.
If somebody had poured this for you and you didn't see the can or know what it was, you could smell it and be like, smells like some kind of strawberry dessert, you know?
It even kind of looks like strawberry shortcake. Like, it's like a cakey kind of color with a little pinkish hue. I'm just saying, I'm getting creative and out of the box thinking
okay.
here.
But I was like, about to say, it's really grapefruit in there, appearance, but...
There's like a creamy foam on top that's kind of like if you had a little whipped cream on that strawberry shortcake.
It is. It's got almost like a meringue consistency.
Imagine if you will... Your strawberry shortcake that's soaked up a little bit of that strawberry juice, turned a little pinkish, you know, so you got like a yellowy pinkish tinged thing.
Yeah, you can keep imagining that. I'm drinking the beer, and it is delicious.
It kind of smells like those, I still haven't drank it yet because I'm just smelling it and looking at it.
I know, I'm a little bit
early. Have you
ever
had those strawberry cream lifesaver things?
The cream savers, yeah.
Yeah, this smells like those.
Those were delicious. I don't know if they even make those anymore. I don't think they do. But they were
that's nice.
Fantastic. Yeah, it smells really good. Like we mentioned the strawberry aroma. It definitely has like a bit of a shortcake or kind of like a sweet pastry crust to it. And then it does have a tint of sourness, but I think inherently strawberry is a little bit tart, so it could be mostly that I'm detecting in the nose. But
it's like a nice tart strawberry.
It's not, it was a little different than what I was anticipating.
I think I was also not anticipating the kind of silkiness of the mouthfeel.
Yeah.
The aggressive carbonation, I was thinking, you know, it might be a little bit bright and crisp, have a little bit of bite to it, but it's actually pretty smooth.
Yeah, it is. It's very smooth.
It's like a smoothie.
Velvety. Yeah. Pretty tasty beer, though.
Tasty.
Thank you,
thanks,
Matt, for sending that. If you want to check him out, look at Instagram.
Straight from the Griff.
Straight from the Griff.
Yeah, so mentioned the Tampa Bay Beer Week inspired beer mail from Matt. Mm-hmm. So he lives down that way, and you know they've got a pretty good thing going there. Kind of in that same vein, we've recently got, or soon to have an upcoming event here in Raleigh. It's one of the largest beer festivals in North America, Brugaloo. 2024.
Sadly, Lauren and I will be out of town.
You'll be camping or something, right?
Yes.
I'd rather be brugalooing.
Wow, that's rude.
Just kidding.
Yeah. It's a...
Just kidding.
Last year was the first time that Jen and I went, and we actually volunteered, talked about that on the pod last year, but we're doing that again this year, doing the early morning setup, and then it's nice because you get done basically when the festival's kicking off, and you get some complimentary drink tickets, so you can get done with your volunteer shift, pick up some tickets, and go do some sampling.
Complimentary, you say?
Complimentary? Yeah, the tickets are making sure to compliment your hair and your nice complexion and... Oh, that color looks great on you.
Yeah.
But yeah, last year the weather was pretty stinky. It was raining most of the morning, and it kind of carried into the very beginning of the festival, but then it cleared up and the sun kind of came out. So hoping this year that the weather is just good all around. It's going to be coming up in about a month. So it's a two-day event. They have a Friday night sort of block party, 6 to 10 p.m. And that is more of the one rate, all you can drink type event where you get a sample cup for like $45 if you pre-order that, and then you just go around and get, you know, 2 to 3 ounce samples, all you can drink for 4 hours there, which I've not been to that.
That's what we did last year.
Yeah.
We went to that portion. I don't remember it being $45 a person though.
Well, I was a DD, so I didn't pay anything.
Oh yeah, you were like, are you what, not
drinking, Lauren? Was there a reason you didn't drink last year?
Yeah, there was a large child in my stomach.
A large boy. A
large child. In your stomach? Oh, gosh.
Well, he wasn't in my stomach.
Your anatomy is interesting.
I just ate a baby.
I couldn't drink. I ate a baby. I was very full.
I was too full.
I was stuffed.
I was too full.
Yeah, I'd like to go to the block party sometime, but... Fear not if you can't make it to the Friday night block party, or that maybe is not your jam and you'd rather just get a few sample pours and buy some tickets, you can go to the Saturday festivities, and that is a 12 to 8 p.m. lineup. And so same breweries as, you know, food trucks, there's music and all that kind of stuff. There's a big stage where they have like bands going, so it's a really nice event, outdoors, rain or shine. And that one is what Jen and I will be doing this year again, checking out some of the tents after we get our tickets from doing some volunteer setup. So check it out if you are in the area and want to volunteer. They still definitely need people to sign up for different areas. There's setup. You can do volunteering for like helping at brewery tents to fill glasses. Mm-hmm. You can do the dirty work of dumping the gross water buckets.
The old gray water.
Yeah. Because, you know, we got to rinse the glasses and dump them, and then people might take a sip and say, I don't like this, so they just dump it out.
They just spit it out like old slapstick comedy style. Yeah. Take a sip. Spray it everywhere.
Blow a raspberry.
Yeah, you know. Wild at those beer festivals. Got to watch out.
Yeah, so check it out. Brugaloo 2024. They have a website. It's sponsored by Shop Local Raleigh, or organized by Shop Local Raleigh. And sponsored by several local businesses. Yeah. So,
and we're not sponsored by them. We just enjoy going.
Yeah. It's just, it's a big event. It's right in our backyard.
I mean, if we wanted to be sponsored by them, we'll take some tickets.
Something that is in our backyard, Dickinson Ave After Dark was supposed to be this past Friday. And due to inclement weather, it has now been rescheduled to April 5th. So I'll be interested to see if some of the breweries that were supposed to come out for this past Friday will also be on the docket for April 5th.
Because they've expanded, you know, who they've had come. You know, it was really limited to just East Carolina beers, but now we've gotten some more folks coming through in a nice looking lineup. I hope that the, you know, things, it's not as crowded. I remember the last time we went, there was just a lot of lines, and the way that they had kind of reformulated things, it was a little tougher to get a beer, but the event has grown so much, I think, that they're working out those pains from that. So, looking forward to that. We're going to check it out and crush some beers.
Crushing beers. That's what we do best. Mm-hmm. What? Maybe not.
That's literally what we do best.
Yeah.
I'm also in trouble.
Some other big news that kind of broke out that we just recently learned about and thought it'd be good to discuss. If you're familiar with the Cicerone certification program, there's been some pretty big news in that front, because the founder, Ray Daniels, who started the program in 2008, has announced that he is selling ownership to two master Cicerones, Dan Imdeck and Jason Pratt. So Those are two of the only 28 Master Cicerones in the world. So it's a very elite title to have. And so, of course, they've dedicated a lot of time and resources and effort into becoming Master Cicerones, learning about beer and kind of holding up the focuses and the tenets of the Cicerone certification program. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be taking over as leaders, as co-partners of that. And if you're not familiar with the Cicerone certification program, check out their website, cicerone.org. They've got a lot of cool info there. Joe and I are certified Cicerone beer servers. Yes. So that's like the entry level. There's four tiers you can actually get into.
We can serve the heck out of a beer.
Oh, yeah. We're certified to serve you a beer.
We'll serve you. That's why we're here, just to serve you.
You've been served. That's what I always think of when...
Yeah, we're here to serve you divorce papers.
You're being subpoenaed. Just kidding. So that's the entry level one of the program. Level two is the certified Cicerone, followed by level three, advanced Cicerone. And then finally, the sort of peak of Cicerone certification is the master Cicerone. It's very exclusive. It's also very expensive to do the testing. So most people aren't doing that unless they've dedicated years to the industry and the craft.
Yeah.
But the intent of starting that by Ray Daniels when he started the Cicerone program was really just to kind of bring an emphasis to quality beer, quality practices in the industry. So they have sort of like five tenets or focuses that they mention on the website, including keeping and serving beer, meaning basically just how to store it properly, how to serve it properly, clean tap lines, that kind of thing. Knowing about different beer styles. So we talk a lot about the BJCP and recognized beer styles. So I think that's an important area. It's just kind of being familiar with all the different styles, the differences, how they're made, what tendencies and what kind of parameters they have. Mm-hmm. Then there's beer flavor and evaluation, which, you know, we do as novices all the time. We're just always kind of evaluating and tasting beer and talking about how it tastes to us and smells. Then there's beer ingredients and brewing processes. So if you've ever done any home brewing, that might be kind of up your alley there. And lastly, pairing beer with food.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of the Cicerone program is the beer equivalent of sommelier. And I think it's important to kind of push the envelope of what's possible in the beer industry, kind of educating more people, bringing the education to the population, having people that are like educated beer servers, I think helps at establishments as well. We have some local breweries here and tap rooms that have their employees take the certified beer server exam, and it kind of just gives you a little basic knowledge about how do I properly serve a beer. You know, changing out kegs is a big part of that, and then just knowing about different styles, making recommendations and things.
Yeah, it makes them more knowledgeable and ready to make recommendations and also just care more, you know.
Yeah, care about what you're drinking.
So, out of curiosity, does your perception of a brewery change if you see kind of those beer server like certifications and the individuals at the brewery taking those extra steps with the Cicerone courses? Does that change your perception of the brewery itself and the beer?
Yeah, I say, what a bunch of elitist snobs. No, no, definitely not at all. I think it does change it, but for the better, because it shows that the owners and the brewers and stuff care enough about their product to make sure that the people dispensing the beer, giving the beer, you know, are knowledgeable and know how to take care of it and know how to serve it. There's nothing worse than going to a brewery and it's served poorly, that being, you know, the you can tell that draft lines aren't clean, or yet dirty, nasty glasses, mm-hmm. or the beer's like just all foam, or you like watch them pour out like a half a gallon of foam before they get you a full beer. It's just, you know, a bunch of things that kind of just be like, really? Do they care that much about their product if the most important step isn't being taken care of? I think that's a big thing for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I don't hold it against places that they don't have it, but it definitely is like a check in the pros column for me if I go to a brewery and see the certificates on the wall, which is just I mean, it's kind of like if you go somewhere and you see the sanitation grade, and you're like, oh, 98, cool. Like, you're doing a good job here. I feel much safer eating here.
71, okay.
I mean, I'll still have a burger at a place that has an 80%, but yeah. I may be a little more leery about the quality of the food.
I may be sick the next day, but it's yeah. fine.
Can I get that well done?
Yeah. Go ahead and cook that to a burnt crisp.
Yeah.
Do you guys have empty glasses?
Yes, we do.
We do.
Oh.
How did you know?
One last note I'll say about the Cicerone program. There's a great documentary online that follow online. I don't know where. It's one of the streaming services, but it follows a couple guys basically going through and preparing for their Master Cicerone exam. It's Ooh, pretty cool to watch yeah. the whole process and everything.
Yeah, I mean, even just to do the certified beer server exam, like there was a decent amount of studying that we had to do for that and to make sure that we scored appropriately to get certified.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine going to the certified Cicerone, the advanced Cicerone, and ultimately a master Cicerone, yeah. each step getting more and more difficult. And yeah. beyond the test for the certified beer server exam, I mean, it's just an online test you can just pay to take and
yeah.
get a certificate. To do anything beyond that, you have to do in-person testing too. There's some taste evaluation and
yeah.
things like that. So it's a little more rigorous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are we drinking, Nick? You got the can in your hand.
We have a French white pale ale, which right off the bat, very intrigued by that. But this is from Brasserie de Sutter. This is a family brewery surrounded by friendship. Above all, a very humble adventure. The de Sutter brothers, Antoine and Frederick, founded the brewery back in 2008. So this is a European beer, Joe. How did you acquire this?
I acquired this beer. I traveled specifically to France to pick. I visited the Brasserie de Sutter, you know, and yes. I said, oui, beer. Je voudrais un bière, s'il vous plaît.
Costco de la Raleigh.
Yes. No, actually, this was another Costco find. Yes, yeah. we were in Wilmington, and we stopped at Costco on the day we were leaving to grab some things, and they had this European beer pack. And it was a 12-pack of beer. Lauren and I had the first 10, one the other night.
It says,
oh, it was only 10?
It says 10 beers from 5 European countries.
Well, never mind. 10 beers. But
10, 16.9.
We actually had the first one the other night. It was another French pale ale. It was not a French white pale ale, but it was from the same brewery. It was pretty tasty. So I decided, you know, let's crack this one open. It's kind of an interesting one we don't usually get. There's other in that pack, like Czech lagers, German lagers, a couple other styles. But the French pale ales were some of the most intriguing to me. And this one, it's quite white looking in the glass. It's got a little yellowish tint, but around the edges, it's very kind of hazy.
Yeah, apparently, so this brewery, the Brasserie de Sutter, is dedicated to producing small-batch, high-end craft beers for sharing amongst friends and advancing the French beer culture. Since its inception in 2008, it's family-owned and operated, and the success of the Les Folies line of beers has allowed them to move into, like, wider distribution of their beers while still producing the quality of beers that make the de Sutter brothers proud. How sweet.
The Sutter Brothers.
Sutter Brother.
I don't think I actually mentioned the name of the beer. It is La Givre.
Is that a cow or a...
Yeah, there's cows on all their things. I don't know why.
My French pronunciation is not good.
What? I took Spanish.
I took American.
Took a little Espanol.
What does Givre mean? I don't know. Givre translation. What does Google say? Google. It means frost.
Frost. Oh. Not what I would have guessed. Frost. I guess I should have by the can.
Yeah, this
art.
Well, there's snowflakes. That
it's also. Yeah, just very, very winter yeah. looking.
The frost.
But yeah, so this white pale ale, you know, it's just definitely got that dull straw color, a tiny bit of maybe chill haze to it. And then a really nice, thick white collar of foam on top that's super foamy, super light, leaving a lot of lace on the glass already just from swirling it around.
Yeah, flavor profile, pretty balanced. Floral, earthy hops on there, nothing like American Pale Ale style. decent malty back. I think a nice balance between malt and hops, and then a bitter finish.
Yeah. And it to me, it like kind of gets really into that wit beer kind of vibe for me. Maybe in a touch like Belgian-y. Just feel like there's some noticeable yeast character there with some spice and some phenols.
What do you think the ABV is?
Ooh.
6.3?
5.7.
Close. 5.5.
Oof. Dang.
Well done, sir.
Yeah. And it, like you said, it's kind of like a hoppy wit beer. You know? It's nice. It's decent.
Yeah, definitely nice to try some beers from other countries that we don't always have access to, but when you find neat packs like you guys did at Costco.
Yeah, Costco's always got some random finds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Lidl has a lot of good finds from like Germany and other kind of smaller German breweries that you don't always see.
Yeah, they've got like a bunch of like random Czech lagers and things, and then sometimes they'll have some packs of some random stuff. But, you know, France, not really somewhere you think of with beer. Definitely not somewhere you think of if you're thinking of the origin of beer. Trying to set up a transition there.
I went swimmingly.
But today's episode, you know, we've actually gone for a little bit now, but focusing really on ancient beer history and also how beer is the beverage that stimulated civilization. Just going to go out and say that right now.
Put me on record.
Put me on record.
Beer stimulated civilization.
So I'll be honest, when you guys first started talking about this, I thought you were just being very dramatic.
Wow.
I know. But then I started reading things and I was like, well, I could see from the simplistic standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching a video today and they had a callback to Homer Simpson, who apparently in one episode of The Simpsons said that beer is, I believe, the cause and the solution to all life's problems. And I was like, that kind of makes sense. I may have paraphrased that, but I mean, it's not incredibly far-fetched to say that beer saved the world and created civilization as we
modern day civilization.
Depending on who you ask, it may be a little hyperbolic, but I don't think it's out of touch to say that beer was really influential, or it stimulated, as Joe said.
Yeah, because it's funny to think today, modern day beer is a commodity in a, you know, a non-essential expense for many people. Some it is very essential. but we think about beer as just another product that's out there. You know, you think of the myriad of ads and other things associated with beer and beer with drunkenness. But things we don't think about beer as where it may have been established is nutrition. Safe drinking water, the reason for settling down and growing crops, you know, and just very interesting to think about how this beverage has transformed, not only the beverage transformed, but civilization has transformed around the beverage.
Yeah, the two kind of go hand in hand. You know, we see a lot of evolution of civilization, but also the evolution of beer as we know it, kind of through archaeological discoveries and, you know, looking at ancient scribes and what we've unearthed, not we personally, but...
Yes, physically us.
Yeah, we've gone to Mesopotamia and we have unearthed all these artifacts. But yeah, you just see an evolution kind of, it's a tandem process. And so, yeah, you mentioned, you know, the way that beer has influenced or stimulated civilization as far as the kind of settlement or domestication of our early human ancestors, because we often know through history that people started off as like hunter-gatherers. That was kind of the way that they survived and made it through the early kind of Neolithic periods, was just moving around, finding ways to gather crops that were available, wild crops, and then also hunting what was in the land. And they were nomadic in nature, and so there wasn't really any kind of settlement at that time. But you know, we kind of look back to the early, like, Neolithic era, kind of around 10,000 BC, there's evidence that people started to kind of settle down in the areas that were really fertile in Mesopotamia, which is kind of like called the Near East or Asian regions at the time.
The Fertile Crescent.
The Fertile
you might
Crescent.
Say.
And it was fertile because, yeah, it just, as it says, it was like, it had access to water. Crops were really fertile there. There was a lot of wild crops growing there, a lot of grains. And with that comes a lot of debate, ironically, because certain researchers have long believed for decades that the reason for domestication of crops and people settling down in that region, kind of disembarking from the hunter-gatherer stage and kind of being more sedentary, was to have access and renewable access to crops, specifically grains for bread. And now we have had arguments since maybe the 1950s that the real impetus for settling was not to have grains for bread, but grains for beer. Mm-hmm. Through an accidental discovery that if you have grains that are basically germinating or have been exposed to moisture and then they germinate and ferment from wild yeast, it creates a concoction that produces alcohol. And the effects of that are pretty great. So there's a lot of archaeological digs. We talked, I think, in the last two episodes that there were digs in the last, decade where they have evidence of remnants from beer on clay pots found at these sites that are 9 to 10,000 years old or even older than that. And so it kind of lends more credence to the fact that, early settlers were maybe influenced by wanting to reproduce this magical beverage or porridge-like beverage and they wanted to reproduce that. And so, hey, we know that this crop is available here. Barley is, prevalent. Let's kind of settle down here and be able to have access to this and kind of reproduce this over and over again.
Yeah. And there's other cultures too that have shown some changes as well, because there's been, the debate of, well, were grains used for food or for beverage first? And some of the ancient civilizations had a similar crop to today's maize. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what the name of it was, but it basically, researchers found that it actually wasn't that suited for making tortillas or bread or other, grain-based food products. It actually was served better for brewing beer. So there's kind of this big debate, bread or beer?
Bread or beer.
Bread or beer, which made humans stop running around chasing animals and stopping to grow things and then store it. So a lot of debate there, but I think a lot of, solid points that say beer could have been a huge influence on humans, taking a break from that nomadic lifestyle, setting up shop, just getting rid of those commitment issues, really settling down, having a family, starting the family farm, creating overalls, putting straw in their mouths.
Beer was the catalyst for men to start settling down and just making families.
Yeah,
just making. They just couldn't commit before beer.
Couldn't commit, then beer made them commit. But yeah. I think along that line also, you've got the food, you've got the drink, and then you stop, settle down. But beer also has another very important ingredient within it. It's alcohol.
Yeah.
Also known as a...
What?
Social lubricant.
Some what?
People say.
There's yeah. alcohol in this?
Oh, sorry. We didn't get you alcohol-free
what?
Beer.
No.
I like to think about early humans in 10,000 BCE. There's just saber-toothed tigers running around, but they're like, let's just pop open this pot of beer. Let's just crack a cool one with the boys and just socialize,
Yeah.
Let's just... How you doing, man? Let's just catch up. It's been a while.
Here, have a straw.
They're just socially lubricated from the beer.
They didn't have podcasts then. They cracked a beer. They had to literally crack open the pot, the clay pot, spill it out, drink the contents off the ground.
But yeah. Well, and yeah, again, so there's, some more credence to the theory that we have beer as a staple for those early domesticated civilizations, basically when all of their needs were met as far as sustenance and shelter and health and safety, then I mean, really the next thing was kind of like you said, the social lubricant or something that kind of provides excitement for them. So alcohol as an intoxicant was kind of believed to be a big driving force for wanting to stay somewhere where you have access to a resource like barley, which you could then germinate and have ferment, which at the time they didn't really understand the properties of fermentation and wild yeast causing the alcohol to be produced. They kind of just assumed, oh, I get this grain, you know, it's mashed. It's kind of the, you know, they may not know the science behind it, but the starch is now accessible to the water to kind of create your mash. And then that provides a source of fermentable sugar for the wild yeast to then create the byproduct of alcohol. And so, you know, they kind of, that was the next thing. It was kind of like the early stages of how do we find enjoyment? Because life at that time was kind of survival mode. It was, you know, finding somewhere to live safely for periods of time, finding a source of food, not getting killed by the wildlife at the time. And
disease
was terrible. Yeah. And we'll kind of go into a little more later, but like beer, I think was really monumental for survival in the sense of, you know, combating a lot of bacterial diseases too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So not only like settling down, creating beer, but then like you said, enjoyment, bringing beer into social gatherings, and then really kind of building that social structure that's involved with civilization. You know, it was enjoyed by everyone. You know, beer made it easier for groups to get along. It was involved in a lot of religious or important ceremonies that people had. You know, they buried beer with the dead. They poured beer on the ground to feed their ancestors and make for, you know, good crop harvests and things like that. And just a huge variety where beer became part of the culture and how this like civilization thrived and grew.
Yeah. And so from there, I think we kind of see the early settlers in the Fertile Crescent, that kind of Mesopotamian region. And over the next, you know, several thousand years that evolved, I think their practices kind of evolved with the group settling and changing over time. And so the Sumerians and the Babylonians, which were kind of the early pioneers of that early beer brewing process, you know, again, they had sort of something similar to like a porridge. It wasn't really a drink that we now know beer to be, you know, fully liquid. This was kind of a hybrid drink where it had a consistency that was thicker, kind of porridge-like, because they didn't have the technology to create a, you know, a liquid-only beer from this process of having like germinated grain and then have it fermented. And, you know, to have the liquid separated, they had to kind of make do and make their own process for doing that. And so one of the things they did to get around the problem of having this mashy, slightly wet thing was to have straws invented. And
tell us about the straws, LC.
The early Sumerians hated turtles.
And they invented the straw to kill them in the future.
Well, they did invent the straws as kind of like a communal way of many people enjoying, because it was a social aspect and they were all drinking out of one big pot of this porridge-like beer. It's very communal.
Very communal.
Yeah, like a party bowl, like a party margarita.
Pargarita.
Pargarita.
But yeah, like Nick said, they invented the straw. And they would drink them out of these big vessels, as Lauren said, the party bowls, basically. But because their beer was so thick, unfiltered, it still had all the grains in it and everything. It was kind of like a porridge-like consistency, I guess. So they invented straws, took those straws, slurped out the juice, filtered out any sort of grains or herbs or other flavorants that they had in there. And that's how they drank their beer. You know, they didn't crack open a cold one. They sipped on
a warm one.
Warm one.
With a straw. A
chunky warm one. Mmm. Yeah. Delightful.
Yeah, you basically get a really cloudy product that's just gross looking. If you look up anything that's like supposed to have been like a replicated, you know, Mesopotamian beer, kind of the early ancient beers, they're just a mash. It's like a separation of the grain kind of bed at the bottom, and then you get this cloudy, murky, slightly pale looking liquid that rises, but
yeah,
it's like you're kind of sipping that off the top and then just dumping out the gross stuff. Now we have technology that we can easily separate the mash from the liquid, and we get, you know, more of a refined product, a filtered product. But
yeah, well, even brewing
not
techniques
possible then
understand a little more how to separate those just right. By the process of brewing. You know, we don't really stick grains and water in a big vat anymore and hope it turns into beer. Very controlled process with introduction of specific microbes. But one thing that was, you know, notable from the Sumerians and Mesopotamian culture is there was a poem, Sumerian poem, that was the hymn to Ninkasi, which Ninkasi was the goddess of beer. And this hymn actually contained a recipe for beer. And it was first written down in 1800 BCE, but they thought that, you know, this brewing practice had been around for, you know, thousands of years beforehand, but this was just kind of one of the first written beer recipes. So Mesopotamians, Sumerians, they really kind of locked down beer brewing, even though there's evidence from, you know, 13,000 BCE in some sites in modern day China.
Yeah, and interestingly, the early brewers were the women in those civilizations, as evidenced by the kind of homage to the goddesses in their culture and their religion. But yeah, it was a good practice for women to brew at the time.
Which is interesting to contrast to today. It's more the minority to have women brewers, mm-hmm. I feel like. So.
Yeah, because there's definitely a push for that. I think in North Carolina, there's, you know, mm-hmm. we have a few women-owned and women-brewed breweries.
Women-brewed breweries.
Well, women-owned, but also, like, yeah, women that are in the brewing process, because it's definitely an industry that's been kind of dominated by men for most of its, you know, time. But we're seeing a push kind of to get more women involved. And I think there's a lot of women that want to be involved. And so... definitely a contrast from how initially it was only women brewing, and now that has taken a back seat, but we're starting to see some mm-hmm. kind of breakthrough in that industry now.
Yeah, Lauren has said she's going to take over the home brewing operations here.
What?
Elsie's homebrew.
We do need a brew. We need a brew.
We do need a brew.
Elsie's brew of the week.
Yeah, whoa. The hymn you were talking about, I don't know if it's true or not. I think there's some kind of theory that the hymns were also a way to kind of easily remember the brewing recipe and processes. So,
you take
which makes sense because a song is so much easier to retain things. yeah, it's like if you have a hymn that sort of, it's like how we learn the 50 states or the presidents. It's like you put it in a song and it's like so much easier to retain that somehow. So I can see where that'd be like almost a device for kind of transferring on the knowledge to the next generation.
They also invented the mnemonic device.
Known for beer and mnemonic devices.
Yes.
Yeah, so beer was, you know, definitely a part of the culture, and as far as just the settlers having sustenance, having nutrition, you know, having the clean mm-hmm. water, basically, because without water filtration, there was a risk of contaminants in water. And so by having a fermented beverage, then you're drinking a safer product and getting some of that nourishment too. But it got so big that it wasn't just part of a survival need, but it also came into like laws in the civilization. So in Babylon, when they had the Code of Hammurabi conscribed, there's actually laws that are specific to beer. I did not know that. There's actually three paragraphs in the Code of Hammurabi that are all about rationing beer and how it should be served, and that, you know, basically you will not tarnish the beer or water it down. There's like death penalties if you go outside of the Code of Hammurabi as far as it pertains to beer. So it was pretty serious to the point where they had laws about it in, you know, the early 1700 BC era.
You know what they say, a beer for a beer.
That's not even funny.
It really wasn't.
Cricket, cricket, cricket.
Chirp, chirp, chirp. But yeah, so, you know, beer was very valued like Nick said, not only for its antimicrobial purposes and its, you know, drunkenness purposes and all whatever, but also its nutritional value. You know, it has more nutrition than unleavened bread. You know, that fermentation process that it undergoes creates a lot of essential vitamins and minerals from the yeast. And then not only that, but you get carbohydrates and whatnot from the beer, and it's just hydrating. I mean, when we were talking about beer back then, we're talking about, you know, 1-2% alcohol by volume. So high enough to kill some microbes and the boiling process killing microbes and whatnot, even though probably at this time they weren't really boiling it. They were just kind of letting it sit and fester. But, you know.
Which seems to me like it'd be more susceptible to, like, harmful bacteria growth.
Yeah.
It's just like room temperature bacteria feasting on sugars. It's like, couldn't that have been, that could have gone the wrong way, but it didn't.
I do think at some of these ancient sites, they have found like furnaces and fire pit sites and stuff. So I do think there was some heating associated with it, but I don't think
they weren't lagering.
Boiled the wort and did all that. That's what they sang.
Well, I mean, this just makes me want to have a PB and beer.
I was going to say,
like a
I'm not packing sandwiches for lunch anymore.
Just beer and peanut butter.
This is healthier, boss. So yeah, you have to let me drink this. It's for my health.
It's for health.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of evidence that beer was a commodity for trade as civilization started to grow elsewhere. And, you know, trade routes were established. You know, beer kind of made its way from that kind of Mesopotamian region. We know that they actually really influenced beer culture in Egypt. The Sumerians from Mesopotamia, they were known to have traded beer to Egypt. And while beer in Egypt has, you know, a long history, I think their process and kind of refinement of that process was spurned by what they learned from the Sumerians. So, interesting thing that a lot of people might already know, but the building of the pyramids of Giza was kind of on the, well, we know it's on the shoulders of so many laborers that were slaving away for years putting together these monuments, but they were able to actually be sustained and were paid or compensated by beer. And again, you mentioned that kind of light ABV, something that's not going to be a 10% ale, of course, because then you have drunk people carrying or moving heavy
stones.
But, you know, something light that was light and it was, you know, refreshing, maybe not cold, of course, because there's no filtration or refrigeration processes at the time. There's no ice. But it was something that was like cooling, refreshing, and it was like providing nutrients to them to keep them going. I think they got a loaf of bread and like maybe 2 to 3 liters of this beer every day to help kind of build the pyramids.
Yeah.
And so
nobody pays me in beer.
What was it? Is that a gum commercial?
Yeah.
Nobody pays me in gum.
Pays me in gum.
If that's what you prefer.
Oh, man. But yeah. So when you're talking about Egyptians and beer, you know, Egyptians were one of the notable beer cultures because they refined really the brewing practices of the Sumerians and were thought to be like one of the first civilizations to really perfect the art of making beer. And they made a beer that was much more similar to what we would know today because it actually was able to be drunk from a glass, not just from a big vat with a straw. You know, you could actually pour it and it was lighter in body and was actually a liquid that you could drink. This beer was used, you know, all over Egypt and had a lot of significant meanings to it. You know, of course, Nick said that they used it as a form of compensation as in part of daily rations, but it also was hugely involved in religious ceremonies and other events that went on. You know, pharaohs being buried with beer, just beer across all social status.
Yeah, and because we kind of talked about the gruel-like or the porridge-like consistency of the early beer that was sort of an accidental byproduct of the barley and the grains that had been germinated and then had wild fermentation occurring, making it more difficult to kind of consume as a beverage versus just kind of a liquidy mash or, you know, a mess. This is where we kind of see that the early stages of that beverage and less of like a hybrid of a food, oatmeal type food and drink. So actually, there's a really cool article I read from the BritishMuseum.org where they replicated or kind of tried to recreate an ancient Egyptian beer recipe. And some of the team were kind of mixed on like, oh, I thought this was just going to be like a clumpy, messy kind of gruel versus a drink. And they were surprised to find out that, you know, the people on the other side of that argument said, no, I think it's going to be more similar to modern beer. And it ended up being something that worked out. And they said it actually was pretty tasty, which is surprising to me. I would have thought it would have been like more or less tasteless or just kind of tastes more like barley.
Yeah.
It just would taste like grain. But, you know, a lot of modern day light ales or lagers, I mean, they have pronounced malt character. And so we kind of come to know them as being just like a, you know, barley beer or barley pop or whatever. So
barley wine.
Barley wine. But yeah, I mean, it definitely was more similar to what we know today as like a modern beer before. And that was before it even got introduced to Europe. And, you know, we'll kind of talk about that in a later installment. But, you know, this was kind of the foreground, kind of setting the stage for modern beer as we know it now. So,
yeah. And when we talk about, you know, religious aspects of beer for the Egyptian culture, there's a very interesting story of the goddess Hathor, which really is this myth that goes on to explain a story of the god Ra, who pretty much says, like, you know, unhappy with humans and they're terrible and evil, so he sends Hathor to humanity to destroy basically all of Ra's creation. So Hathor goes and gets in a crazy bloodlust and slaughtering everyone and crushing towns and stuff, and then turns into the goddess Sekhmet. Ra is like, okay, this is cool, destroying what I said, but then afterward he's like, maybe this is a little too intense.
Okay, dial back a little bit.
Let's take it back a notch. So he's like, you know, what I can do is I'm going to take a ton of beer and dye it red so it looks like blood. So that way she'll, you know, drink all that. And she does, and then wakes up, and she's like, oh, I'm very docile, and now I'm just going to reward all the people for this great creation of beer. And pretty much, bloodlust is satisfied and becomes the goddess of, and then becomes Hathor, you know, the deity of music, laughter, the sky, and gratitude. So look what beer did. Transformed bloodlust into gratitude. Can't get any better than that.
It reminded me of Moana. So I'm going to probably butcher how this whole story is played out, but there's Te Fiti, who's like kind of the antagonist initially in Moana, but really she's just a misunderstood goddess. She has this like wrathful presence. She looks like a person that's a volcano, but all she needed to be restored to Taka is she had her heart stolen. And so Moana restored that heart to her, and she transformed from that misunderstood kind of, evil looking lava spewing creature into this lush green life giving goddess. And so it's kind of like, you know,
turns out her heart was beer.
Her heart was beer. Yeah. I mean, Moana, you know, as a Disney movie, probably can't introduce concepts of beer, but has some similarities there. I wonder if there's any kind of connection. Like, we know over time stories kind of evolve across different cultures and they get adapted, but kind of had a similar vibe there, but.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, one thing I like to note, there's an inscription that was found that's said to be from 2200 BCE, found at Dendera, which was Hathor's cult center. Basically, the quote is, "The mouth of a perfectly contented man is filled with beer." Can't get any better.
I can't really argue that, so.
No. Should we move on to Greece and Rome? When in Rome. Well, it's kind of a sad story because the Greeks and the Romans hated beer. They said it's for low-class fools, they drank wine instead. They said that wine was for low-class citizens and for barbarians. which was very interesting. And one quote that the Roman historian Tacitus said, writing of the Germans, says, "To drink, the Teutons have a horrible brew fermented from barley or wheat, a brew which has only a very far removed similarity to wine." And others said the Emperor Julian composed a poem claiming the scent of wine was of nectar while the smell of beer was that of a goat.
That's harsh.
Yeah, you know, the Romans and Greeks, not huge fans.
Yeah.
But that being said, the Romans were actually brewing beer, and they called it cervecia, which is where the Spanish word cerveza comes from. And there's, you know, a lot of history within Rome about brewing beer. But again, I mean, it was always just associated with the lower class citizens and not really drank by the nobles. So,
yeah, definitely seems like a class separation. It was very classist at the time to drink wine in those civilizations, kind of like an elitist beverage to beer. And I still kind of think, like, in some ways that is perpetuated, where mm-hmm. like wine is kind of seen as like this elegant beverage yeah. at dinner. But I think we're kind of squashing that notion a little bit now. Not we personally.
Yes,
the
us.
Collective we.
We're the crusaders.
Yeah, you're welcome. But yeah, we're kind of squashing that a little bit by, you know, people like Ray Daniels. Call back to the beginning of this episode. Like
people
the Cicerone
like Jack
program.
Daniels.
People like Jack Daniels. Ray Daniels, Jack Daniels, you know, they're kind of putting an emphasis on, hey, beer can be consumed and enjoyed in the same way and fashion that we enjoy a beverage like wine. We can pair it with food. We can have evaluations of it. We can have sommelier-esque people like that are educated in the beverage and the craft. So,
and some may argue that beer is better to pair with food than wine, because it's just got a greater variation in flavor. Yeah. I mean, beer has such an amazing spectrum of what it is. You know, we had a dark lager to a strawberry shortcake sour, you know, very extremely different styles that would pair with very different things. Whereas wine is kind of similar across the board. I mean, still huge variations in wines that are available, but argument could be made that beer is more flexible and better to be paired.
And you know who really believed that at the time? The Germans.
The Germans.
So, yeah, kind of the last little bit of the ancient beer history as we know it is this kind of transfer of beer and kind of a movement up into Germany, where kind of around 800 BC is where Germans were creating this. They were kind of adopting the practices that had been, you know, transferred from as early as the 10,000 BCE Mesopotamian era down to Egypt and upward into Europe. And while other European countries were kind of, or European civilizations were rejecting beer as a, you know, valuable part of civilization, the Germans were, you know, embracing it wholeheartedly, and they brewing it a lot, actually. And so, I mean, it's kind of history when we look back, even a couple episodes previously, we've talked about the kind of early German and monastic breweries that were established in that area. It also spread to Belgium too, but that was really big at the time to incorporate beer into religion, which we've seen in other civilizations. So actually it was kind of where monks started brewing was in Germany. And so Christianity kind of embraced beer as part of its imbibement, if you will. And I've read some things where they kind of offered it as like a token of coming to mass. It's like, hey, come to church and you get a beer afterwards. Beer. So
sounds like a great plan.
Yeah, it was really integral for the monastic lifestyle, as we know, and we've already talked about, but it goes back even as early as, you know, before the Common Era. So Germany's kind of the ones that really evolved beer in Europe, because after it left the kind of Neolithic era, obviously Egypt was big into brewing, and now we know Egypt is not as prevalent of a beer country as it used to be at the time when it was a necessity.
Not many flannels there.
Yeah. Yeah. Germany, you know, they were not as early as some of those other, adopters and, pioneers of beer, but they kept it the longest, and they kind of continued to grow and evolve, you know, as early as 800 BCE. So
yeah,
we definitely see now where Germany has become sort of the standard and sort of a mecca for modern beer. But, you know, they kind of were the ones that said, hey, if, you know, the Romans and the Greeks aren't going to do it, like, we value beer. We find it has its place and its purpose. And, you know, again, they adopt a lot of the same principles, a lot of the same religious ties to the beverage. And it had the same kind of, like, vital significance to their civilizations surviving and providing sustenance, too.
Yes.
I need more beer.
But, yeah, so, you know, that was a full-on discussion of, you know, ancient beer and, you know, before common area beer stuff. And we're thinking about doing a little series on the history of beer. You know, next we'll be talking, we talked a little bit about the oldest breweries and some of the monastic brewing there. But I think if we talk about some of the Middle Ages, maybe up to, you know, modern day, and then the transformation probably in the last 100 years or so, we'll probably bust those out into a few different series. Because it's very interesting, you know, thinking about how this beverage has gone on for so long, you know. It's not like you can do the anthology for Monster Energy, you know.
but not yet. Maybe yeah, in a thousand yet. Years, we'll see.
Yes, all the bros with the tattoos.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it's great.
But, yeah, there's, spoiler alert, there's a lot of cool, kind of coincidental moments in time where beer played a very big part of expansion and pioneering and kind of new settlements. So
yeah, yeah. A lot of rich history in beer. And with that, we'll go to Elsie's Pick of the Week.
Elsie's Pick of the Week. First time in a couple episodes.
Assume the positions.
It's first time in a couple episodes that we actually have Elsie present for the pick.
It is. She's been absentee picking.
She's very busy raising that child of yours. He's so needy. He just needs to be fed and coddled and rocked to sleep.
Changed and
played with and read to. And my goodness, I mean, when will it end?
It's a leech.
Are you just going to let this kid control your life?
Children, leeches on our society.
Ooh, that was a crack.
That was like a locked and loaded crack. Too bad I was talking over.
Do we have fresh glasses?
We do.
Okay. Hopefully you can reach my hand. I'm sorry if you can't.
Oops, that was a terrible pour. Apparently I just started pouring beer.
Well, apparently I've never poured a beer before.
Apparently I need water.
I've never been on television. You know what's funny is, like, Elsie could prank me or both of us so hard. I'm sitting here with my eyes closed, my arm extended, waiting for a glass to get in there. I could just be doing this for minutes, and she just leaves. Me a beer. And she's out of the room, and I'm like, okay, well, maybe she's still pouring. I don't know.
Did you see that video? I think I sent you a TikTok of this guy. His account's like somebody versus beer, and he like does a blind beer tasting and he's like, oh, I think this is a cider. I can't tell what fruit this is.
Oh, I did see that.
And he goes on and on. And then it turns out to be like Miller Lite or something. It reminded me of the time that she duped us with Busch Light.
Or Busch Heavy, wasn't it?
It was Busch Heavy. Yeah, it was Busch Heavy.
See, that's why, you know, I don't usually drink Busch Heavy. So I wasn't sure
the beer,
what it smelled like.
The glass was more full than I anticipated. I got a nose. Yeah.
My nose got so wet.
This is smelling roasty.
Yeah, definitely smells like a darker, malty beer. Smells roasty, maybe a touch nutty.
Little, like, chocolatey hazelnut. Maybe not hazelnut. But, like, chocolate roast, a little bit of char. Some nice caramelization. I'm going for a sip.
Yep. So right off the bat, the foam, which was really, you know, really prevalent, it's actually just really loose bubbles, really light foam. It's kind of like more wispy.
Fighting through the bubbles here.
Yeah, I noticed as like it hit my upper lip, it was like the bubbles kind of just felt like a like cobwebs, just really wispy and light. But underneath is a really smooth, light-bodied beer.
Mm-hmm. And it's got a nice, like that roasty character is very prominent.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit bitter, but not off-putting or, you know, overly charred. It's kind of like a nutty, chocolatey, not smoky, but you know what I'm saying, like almost just a little touch of char.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you bite into a well-cooked pizza. It's got a little bit of blackened edges on it.
Yeah, you like that well-done pizza crust.
I'm going to look at it. Oh, yeah. That's the color I was expecting it to be.
Yeah. It's light enough in body and in like roast character that I'm leaning more towards maybe a porter than a stout. But I could potentially see it being a stout. I'm gonna assume that it's a porter. I think that's my guess for the
it's
style.
Almost like an Irish stout kind of style, you know, like just the lightness, dryness of it.
Yeah, but it could be a
porter.
Could be a dry Irish stout. Now, if you guess that, and I guess porter, I think we've really narrowed in on our.
Oh, sorry, yeah. It's a hazy IPA.
Son of a. There's a touch of like a reddish hint in the brown color. It's like dark brown, but it's got some light peeking through, and it gives off some red tones.
You both have had this previously.
We have.
Oh, okay.
Intriguing.
Well, is it a porter or an Irish stout?
Is it? Or just a stout?
It's neither.
Oh, no. We hedged our bets and still lost. Is it a brown ale?
It's not brown. It's very black. Wait, this is neither a stout nor a porter?
No.
What?
Is it like a specialty stout?
So.
Oh my gosh, what the heck? What are we forgetting, Joe? Let's go deep into the library of our beer style knowledge.
Deep into the library.
It just tastes to me like it's got to be...
Yeah, I don't know what it
like
would...
Like a light stout or... I really thought it could be a porter, but...
It's not a, like a... Just think of other dark styles. It's like not a... It's not a Bock. Is it a Bock?
No.
Johann Sebastian?
But is it like a dark lager? Just like a dark...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
It is.
A Dunkel?
But this is very dark, like...
Super, yeah.
But it's a lager?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Dunkel, not a Bock. Is it a... Ooh, what else is there?
A Maibock. Is it just a dark lager?
Yeah, that's all it is. So this is from our friends in Cooperstown, Brewery Omegang.
Oh, Brewery Omegang, hello.
This is the Metal Legion Lager.
Mm.
So it has boasting dark lager. It's an old world style.
Very dark lager.
Take of the dark lager. It's a brew. Oh my gosh. This brew is a Belgian take on it. And it's brewed with their Belgian lager yeast. Rich aroma, light, full flavor, mouthful with subtle notes of Belgian chocolate. It's fermented cold to provide a light, easy drinking body and a clean, crisp finish. And then along the way, there are hand-selected spices, which include coriander and orange peel, which I didn't really pick up a lot of at all.
Yeah, I didn't get a lot of Belgian character.
Belgian yeast?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like an ale to me.
It's a midnight lager with orange peel and coriander.
Now, very interesting. Because you do, and I think that's why we're leaning so heavily towards stout or porter, because you get that fruity, you know, yeast character through, which, if they use Belgian yeast, do they have a Belgian lager? Like, I understand they cold fermented it, but did they use lager yeast? Or, because then are we getting into the nuances of what's actually a lager?
Lager? I hardly know her.
Classic. Well, we definitely got
duped.
Yeah, well, that's a good one to pick because it really tested.
He's a very tricky boy.
Bam-boozled.
Yeah, really tricky. Really tested us.
I don't know how you would know otherwise.
Mm. I guess we're not ready to be master cicerones just yet.
No.
We just skip the certified and advanced cicerone and go straight to master cicerone.
We're here for the master cicerone test. You failed miserably.
We'll be testing as a team today. Sir, you can't do that.
Why are you wearing tuxedos? I thought it was a joke. Now I just realize you're insane. Oh, man. What'd you learn today, Nick? Elsie abandoned us to go take care of the child. But what'd you learn? I think you probably learned a lot.
Oh, yeah, I did. I think a really profound thing that I learned today was the importance of women in ancient brewing and civilizations that at the time were maybe not, you know, given same opportunities as men, but they were given an opportunity to be the pioneers of brewing, and they were able to then use that product to earn some money for themselves, have some independence, and barter with that beer and get other goods from it. So
yeah,
empowered women. And you know, as Elsie kind of mentioned earlier, it's interesting how that's not really the case now, where women are dominating the craft beer industry, but you know, hopefully we kind of see a continued shift where we see growth in women in the beer industry.
Yeah, and I mean, even the opposite of that, we've seen, like, you know, some allegations of bad things happening at breweries towards women. So, you know, really got to gain that respect back. Women being not only the first home brewers, but the first microbrewers, too. You know, selling their product, so.
They were integral to the success of those civilizations, and for them to thrive, they needed beer, and those women were the ones providing it. So
yeah. You know what I learned today? I learned that the Sumerians hated turtles because they invented the straw. They didn't use plastic straws, but they knew turtles one day would face the wrath of the straws that they've created. So dang you Sumerians. Yeah, I think I just learned a lot of good, rich history and kind of the timeline. You know, the fact that beer's been around for so long, it's just kind of crazy. We're looking like 15, 16,000 years kind of stuff. And it's, you know, I'm sure these things have happened. You know, obviously now we have a better understanding of how beer is made and why beer is made and yeast and all that stuff. And not necessarily attributing fermentation to godlike presences and divine power. But, you know, beer does still have a divine power.
Yeah,
all of us.
And kind of a bonus one, it's just like how many opportunities there were for beer to fail or to not be a prevalent part of growth. But also on the flip side, if beer hadn't been accidentally discovered, like who knows where we would be as a planet now. So
you wouldn't even be here today.
People wouldn't have settled. We'd still be hunting and gathering.
The giant nomadic tribes running around killing the animals.
Nomad land.
Nomad.
Shout out Francis McDormand.
On that note, that concludes episode number 78. Check us out on our socials on Instagram at Secondary Fermentation, Facebook, East Carolina Beer and Brewing. Send us an email or send us some beer. You can reach out to us at Gmail, eastcarolinabeer@gmail.com. Check out our website, eastcarolinabeer.com. And we will see you in episode number 79.
Cheers.